Welcome to another episode of Daughters of Mormonism. I'm your host, Sybil. Today, I'll be interviewing another of our panelists, Heather. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Sybil.
So good to have you on the podcast.
It's good to be here.
For our listeners' benefit, we are also having a partial interview from Isaac, your young son, right?
Yes, he would not go to bed before our scheduled time. Usually he does go to bed, but he didn't today.
So we'll just enjoy his charming personality as we go. So first of all, tell us about yourself. What's been your history with the church? What's sort of your life story?
I grew up in the church. My parents are both converts to the church. They both converted in their teens. They met each other in college through LDSSA and got married. So mostly, like, all of my memory that I can actually really remember was in a suburb of Chicago from when I was 10 and on. I mean, we lived a little bit in rural Indiana and Texas and stuff for that. I did all the, you know, standard Mormon things. I was baptized on my 8th birthday. I went through the Young Women's Program. I got my little Young Women medallion thing. I went to BYU. I studied math. And so at that point, I moved to Utah. And then we just recently moved out to the Bay Area for my husband's job. And we are loving it out here. I love the Lord. And so I consider myself an active, believing Mormon. I currently teach Sunbeams. That's my calling. But I've had pretty much every piano calling in existence, except for, like, Elder's Quorum Pianist, because apparently I'm not an elder.
Tell us how you met your husband and how you got married, and what we'll move from there toward your children.
Well, it's pretty standard BYU story. He was in my ward. I had a missionary that I wrote to a lot, and I was totally in love with my missionary, so I wasn't actually particularly looking, but I was kind of a flirtatious person, and I was always, I guess, looking. The weekend of Thanksgiving, all of my roommates had gone home, and I didn't, and so there were, like, only 13 of us from the ward who still stayed in our apartment complex. And because there's no one else to hang out with, we all hung out with each other, and that's when I got to know my husband, McKay, and that's, a week after that, we had our first date officially, and a couple weeks after that, we officially were dating each other, and a couple of months later, we got engaged, and then 6 months later, we had a long engagement, we got married, so long for Mormons, at least, at BYU, 6 months long, but not to anyone else.
So how long was it before you had your first child?
My daughter is 3, and I got pregnant 10 months after, so pretty quickly, sort of. McKay's family, they all got pregnant much sooner than that, so they were all like, Heather, it's been like 9 months. Where's your baby? But, so yeah, we got pregnant about 10 months into the marriage. My family was shocked that it was so soon, because they had always been like, you know, enjoy that time as a couple before you add to your family. So it was interesting to have the two different dynamics going on there. And then Margaret is now 3 and Isaac is 10 and a half months old. So this is exciting. And so is Margaret, of course. She's not here.
So most women in the United States have their babies in a hospital, and there's a growing number that are having their babies with the assistance of a midwife, but you chose a different route, and even there. Will you tell us about the birth of your children and about how you chose what you decided to do?
Right, yeah. I chose to forego both of those options and have my babies at home without any medical attendant at all, no midwife, no doctor. My husband was at both of them. And at my daughter's, I had a really long labor, and so I had called a friend, and she had brought up her food, and she stayed until my daughter was born, but she was not a professional midwife or even a doula at that point. She's a doula now, but at that point, she was not anybody official, and she was just a friend. I chose that. It's BYU's fault. BYU in educating the young people. I was required to take anthropology 101, well, a social science. I studied math, and so all of my sciences were totally covered, but you have to be well-rounded. So I was taking Anthropology 101, and we read a book called The Spirit Catches You When You Fall Down. And this book is not about birth whatsoever. It's about a Hmong family who leaves Laos and comes to America, and their daughter has epilepsy. And it's about their struggles with the medical community and how different they saw medical care from their culture and what it was like to be in America with this, the medical care that we have here. And one of the ways they demonstrate the difference is that they tell the story of the mother's births in Laos, and they tell the story of her births, the few births that she had in America, to contrast the two systems. The births in Laos, she was by herself. She woke up in the middle of the night and had a baby and went right back to sleep. And that was it. And I read that, and I had never, ever before been exposed to anything about natural childbirth. I'd never been exposed to home birth, really. I mean, I knew people did it, but they were really fringe in my mind. This was the first time I'd ever heard of birth being peaceful. I had only ever seen, you know, what Hollywood gives us. I was of the belief that, you know, we're supposed to have painful birth because of the Eve thing. I know that there's, you know, some other explanations for that part of the creation story, but you just have sorrow with having kids in general. But I don't know, I couldn't get around that. Yeah, it had to be painful. It had to be this big ordeal that your water breaks and you start panting, you're Lamaze, and you go to the hospital. And my mother, all of us were cesareans, and so I was not exposed to any sort of natural birth stuff growing up. So reading this was just kind of a shocker that, oh my goodness, it is not required that it has to be this panicky event. And at that point, I was engaged to McKay. I would joke with him, oh, McKay, someday you'll just come home and I'll have had a baby. Not cool with that idea. But he himself was a home birth, so he couldn't really say anything against home birth, but he was kind of like a little unsure about just, but he wanted to participate in the birth, so he didn't like the idea of him being gone while I have the baby. And he wasn't entirely sure about going, having an unattended birth. So we were engaged for that, and then it was just kind of a joke. And then about a year later, you know, we'd gotten married, I got pregnant, and I really loved that idea. And at that point, I had come across more stories of women doing this in America. I don't know how I ran across it, but there's a site called unassistedchildbirth.com by Laura Shanley. She wrote a book called Unassisted Childbirth and had all five of her children at home unassisted. And I was like, oh my goodness, people in America do this. It's not just something that's out in Laos. And it just brought it closer home. And actually, when I was about 13 weeks pregnant, I actually flew out to Colorado and met her. And that was a really cool thing to actually know someone who had done it. Further into my pregnancy, I had promised my husband that I would see someone, you know, for the prenatal care and stuff. And so I had interviewed a home birth midwife, and I interviewed a CNM because in Utah, that's where my daughter was born. I think CNMs are the only midwives that are allowed to attend hospital births. And so I thought I'd try, you know, I'd interview both and see what I liked. And neither of them, I went away with feeling like that's who I wanted at my birth. And I felt very drawn to doing this. Like, I couldn't get out of my mind this unassisted birth option. So my husband was a little upset with me for not finding someone because I promised I would. And he felt a little let down that he felt lied to that I promised this and I didn't follow through with it. And at that point, we decided that it'd be okay for me to do my own prenatal care. I might look into finding someone for actually attending the birth. And so we bought the little strips that, you know, you pee in your cup and they stick little things in to find out if you have protein or sugar or other issues, you know, pH balance and stuff in your urine. And when you go to the doctor, they test all those things. And so I had little strips to do that myself. And I was taking my own blood pressure. And we got a fetoscope to listen to the baby's heartbeat. And I was measuring my fundus. All of the things that you'd be doing at a regular midwife or doctor appointment, I was doing myself.
What was that like? Did you learn a whole lot? Was it really exciting?
It was exciting. My husband was still in school. At this point, I had graduated. So it was like the thing that kept my mind busy was reading and checking out these books about birth and pregnancy and how to prepare for a birth and stuff. And I thought it was so fascinating. And it was a total paradigm shift for like how I viewed the entire world. At that point in time, I was also questioning a lot of, like, it was kind of the beginning of my questioning authority. Like, I'd already started questioning, like, my parents' authority because, you know, now I'm married and I'm setting up on my own. And now they don't have as much of a say anymore. But now I can question the authority of, like, the mainstream doctor midwife model. I mean, I was young and I was in my early 20s. And that's what you do at that stage of life. And that's just how it showed up in my life. And I actually, at the beginning of my first trimester, went to a support group for unmedicated birth. And it was for any sort of unmedicated birth, hospital, home. And at that meeting, there just happened to be another woman who had all three of her children unassisted. And she was telling her stories, and her mom was with her. And she was telling, she had had unassisted birth. And it was kind of like the world was sending me a message, unassisted birth. And I came home from that and I was like, McKay, people in Provo do this. This is down the street from us. And she had all three of her kids at home, unassisted. And he turned to me and he's like, Heather, I'd already decided I was okay with this. And I was like, you didn't tell me? But he had decided actually the previous Sunday he prayed about it and felt good about it. And I had been praying about it. And I thought that my answer was, Heather, it'll be good. You know, you can have a baby at home or you can have a baby in the hospital. And either way, it'll turn out right. So do what you want. And so I figured, since God's letting me do what I want, then this is what I want. So that's why I went that route.
Will you tell us a little bit about what it was like to have your unassisted births?
Yeah. Well, with my daughter, she was very overdue. Very, very overdue. And I actually think that the reason why I was drawn to unassisted birth with her pregnancy is because if I hadn't, I think I would have been pushed in for an induction. And I would have been possibly failure to progress because I had a really long labor with her as well. I went into labor at 42 weeks and 5 days. And most people don't go that long. And so I was getting a lot of people worried. Oh, Heather, what if something happens to the baby? You're getting really past due dates. It's something to worry about. And I felt like she was moving. And so she was reacting like she had a heartbeat and it was strong. And she, you know, reacting to, you know, when you push your belly, she would react. So there was obviously some sort of living aspect. There's, what do they call it? The non-stress test where they make sure the baby is reacting to outside influence. She was. And so I wasn't worried about her. The overdueness wasn't an issue. When I went into labor, I had a 44-hour labor with her. And so she was finally born at 43 weeks. And I think with her, the hardest part of that labor was not the pain. And it was pain. There was pain involved. But the hardest part about it was feeling like it was never going to end. And I think that was the worst part. And I had felt at one point that McKay had given me a blessing. And I was told that I would have the Spirit guide me in what to do. And I remember thinking, I cannot feel the Spirit. I'm in labor. And I felt like I couldn't feel the Spirit. I felt abandoned by God. And that was the worst part of that labor. When I was finally pushing her out, I was just so happy that I was having a baby that I wasn't noticing the pain so much. She was born in the call, which is the term meaning my water never broke. And so she was born in her water sac and it broke finally when her feet came out. So she was head first, a normal head first vaginal birth. And she just came out fully in her water sac. And then when her feet came out, it broke and McKay caught her. That was a really cool experience. It was also reassuring that through that long labor, she was not exposed to infection. That's one worry when you have a long labor. If your water is broken, they can be exposed to bacteria. But finding out that she'd been in the call meant that she was not exposed to that through the labor. And so that wasn't a worry. Afterwards, I was just really glad that I had chosen that route because I think I would have been induced. Even a home birth midwife would have been thinking about castor oil or other induction methods. Having such a long labor, sometimes doctors and midwives aren't so patient. And sometimes they are. And there are some good doctors and midwives out there. And with my son, I didn't feel so strongly about it. And I was kind of up for whatever. But we moved to the Bay Area when I was 30 weeks pregnant. And when we came out here, we applied for insurance, but were denied because of my pre-existing condition of being pregnant. We kept our insurance in Utah and figured we would just pay out of area of something if someone broke their arm or something. But we couldn't get insurance here. And so we're like, well, I guess we'll try this again. Because at that point, midwives were booked 30 weeks along and you're saying, hey, in 10 weeks, I'm going to have a baby. They're like, my month is already booked up. Can't take you on. So at that point, we figured we'll just do it again since that's what we did with Margaret. And his labor was not so long. I think that the reason I didn't feel very strongly either way with his is because I think it would have been totally fine anywhere. It was a basic 6-hour labor, started in the middle of the night. He was born in the morning and it was pretty textbook. It did take him a little while to breathe when he was born, but we handled that well. He was still attached, was still getting oxygen through the placenta and his cord. And we just dried him off because that helped stimulate them and turned him down a little bit so that anything in his nose could come out. And he started breathing within a few minutes. And because he was still getting oxygen through the placenta, it wasn't an emergency situation.
This is kind of a random question, but isn't there some kind of folklore type thing about children who are born in the call that it's supposed to be like they're going to be a visionary or a great leader or a prophet or a prophetess or something like that?
Yes, there are lots of folklore about that. There's one standard that if you're born in the call, you won't ever die of drowning because you were born in water, so water can't kill you pretty much. And then there's also the belief that they have like second sight or ESP or can see beyond the veil because they were born on the other side of the veil, if you consider the water sack to be a symbol of the veil into life. So since they were born on that side of the veil, they have a special connection to that, is the folklore. Also in that book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, they talk about the traditions of the Hmong women about the placenta, and they would bury their sons' placentas by the door as a protection and their daughters' placentas under the marriage bed for fertility. And it was believed that when you die, your spirit traces your life backwards of where you lived and ends up going to where your placenta was. And they consider your placenta your first clothing and your first garment, and can put that on before you can go on to the next stage in your life, in the afterlife. So that, I think, is also very lovely, that you have to put on this garment to go on to the next life, I think, is an interesting symbolism.
So does your daughter seem to have any second sight ability?
We have always been told that she looks very wise. Like, even at 4 months old, she had an interesting awareness of just around her. Like, I would be sitting in Relief Society, and she would, like, listen to the lesson. Like, when the teacher was speaking, she'd look at the teacher. When someone had a comment, she'd turn her head around and watch them give their comment. And she does seem to be a little bit wise beyond her years. She's 3 now, so she doesn't act like it. I think she's got something special. She's very intuitive, and she kind of knows what's going on when she's not. We've had some hard times lately because we just moved in. It's traumatic for her, but she's very in tune to other people's needs. There was a little girl that she was playing with once, and the little girl was being kind of loud, and Margaret turned to her and said, you know, shh, Isaac's sleeping. And the little girl, like, started crying, and Margaret was like, oh, no, it's okay. Margaret gave her a hug and said it was okay. You know, she didn't mean to. So she's got some sensitivity there. I don't know if that's related to being born in the call or just that she's a sensitive person, but we can say it is because that's fun.
So you did unassisted birth, and you have a strong feeling about breastfeeding.
Yes.
And you even coined this fantastic term, lactivism, and being a lactivist.
I didn't coin it.
You didn't?
No.
Where did you find it? Because it's such a great term.
I found it on the internet. I don't know who came up with it. I think it's a genius term also. When I was pregnant with Margaret, I really wanted to breastfeed, and I sought out resources and stuff. And I remember just online looking for like information about breastfeeding and running into that word and running into people having nurse-ins.
What's a nurse-in?
A nurse-in is kind of like a breastfeeding protest. They coined the phrase because of the sit-ins during the civil rights movement. That's where the nurse-in phrase comes from. I remember the most prominent one that I remember reading about when I was pregnant with Margaret was the Applebee's nurse-in, when Applebee's, a woman had been breastfeeding in the restaurant and she'd been asked to leave. And Applebee's, the corporation of Applebee's, stood behind that branch's manager in that they had the right to do that. And because of that, because sometimes it's just the manager not realizing that the corporation does not actually believe that way. And so sometimes the corporations would tell the manager, no, you really need to allow women to breastfeed here. But this time the Applebee's as a corporation stood behind that manager's right to ask her to leave. And people were very upset about this. And so across the nation, people went to Applebee's and sat out on the lawn or went inside and nursed their babies. That was the August of 2007. But that was like the big one I'd read about when I was pregnant with Margaret. And I remember thinking, oh man, how cool would it be? I have a very strong desire to be an activist. And I remember when I was in fifth grade hearing about suffrage and being like, man, it's such a shame we have suffrage because now I don't have anything to fight for. Like, I just really wanted to fight for something. Of course, you know, at the age of 10 or 11 or whatever, I was in fifth grade, I didn't realize that there's still plenty of things to fight for. So I just something I've always wanted to do. So I really liked that idea. And then when I got pregnant and found lactivism, I was like, this is amazing. Oh, wouldn't it be great to someday like be on the forefront, fighting that fight and unfortunately in that it's a shame that we have to have nurses and that we have to fight for our rights to be seen breastfeeding and to be in the public space. I did get to actually organize a nurse in later when I was nursing Margaret. Yeah, she's still nursing, but when she was a baby.
Tell us about that.
Okay, well, this was for Margaret's like 6 month or so birthday. I got some pictures taken of me and her nursing up at Sundance, actually, Sundance Resort, because we were in Utah at the time. And a friend of mine took the pictures, and I posted a couple of the pictures on Facebook. And someone had flagged them, and Facebook had removed them. And I was really upset about this because you couldn't see any nipple there. I mean, not that that even matters. Specifically, the Utah law specifically says even if nipple shows, it's still considered not indecent exposure. And so I was upset about this. And I found a group on Facebook. They had been dealing with these sorts of issues where Facebook would remove a picture of someone breastfeeding. And they were talking about getting together and doing some sort of action. It was called Hey Facebook, breastfeeding isn't obscene. It still exists, and I'm still involved, although I'm not as actively involved with that at the moment because I have other things going on in my life. But I was on that group, and I was like, what can I do? This isn't right. They can't just take that down because there's nothing obscene about it. And they were planning on something, and I realized that Christmas that year, I was coming out to California to visit my in-laws, and Facebook headquarters is in California. And so I said, well, I'm going to be there over Christmas. Should we do a nurse-in? And they thought that was a great idea. And so we arranged that. I contacted local newspapers and news TV channels. And I tried to contact people to get people to come out to it. It was over Christmas, so we didn't get a huge turnout because, you know, people are vacationing. And it was on the Saturday after Christmas that year. It was 2008, so I think it was the 28th of December. And the people on the Facebook group also coordinated an online nurse-in in which you would put up a picture on your profile as your profile picture of a nursing mom, whether it was you or if you were not in a nursing stage or if you're a man, you could put up a picture of, like, say, the Virgin Mary nursing or someone else. They had some pictures that you could choose from and put up as your profile picture. And I got involved with that. We had signs. We had news people come out. And it went pretty national. I had newspapers all over the country picking it up on the Associated Press. A few weeks later, Provo caught on to it, and they saw that the person who was in charge of it was from Provo. So KSL and, well, ABC4, other local news stations caught on to that and actually interviewed me and did some interviews there as well. It was because of that for Facebook nursing that, like, my blog, my personal blog that I just kind of rant and give my opinions about things, I was getting a lot of people coming to it. And so I did a lot of blogging at that point about the nursing and why I thought it was important. A lot of the criticism I got was that, hey, you are Mormon, and why are you okay with just, like, flushing everybody? That's, or whipping it out, or however people call it. And in Mormonism, we do have a lot about modesty and stuff, but I don't personally feel that breastfeeding is a modesty issue. I don't think that breastfeeding is immodest, and I don't think that God has an issue with it. And I don't use a cover like a blanket or a nursing cover. And I don't always use layers. After my daughter turned 18 months, she refused to use layers. So I either had to completely pull down or completely pull up and see skin and stuff. So what I did January after that December nursing, I wrote a huge blog post about why breastfeeding is not a modesty issue. And that got a lot of traffic and still does. It's one of my most popular blog posts. I talk in it about how it's not women's responsibility to keep men's thoughts in line, and how if you're really thinking naughty thoughts about a woman who's breastfeeding her child, you have issues of yourself on your own, and not her issue at all. She should not be worried about your breastfeeding fetish, you know? On one level, like, I play the piano. Like I said, I've done lots of piano callings, and there are people out there who have hand fetishes, but I play the piano without wearing gloves. I was ward choir pianist. I wouldn't be in another room and have them pumping the sound in because someone might get turned on by my fingers playing the piano. It's just another body part that you use for multiple uses. My hands can be sexual and my breasts can be sexual, but they are not always sexual. And when they are not being used sexually, I don't have a problem with them being seen.
Tell us a little bit about some of the experiences you had at church with people being uncomfortable about you breastfeeding your children.
I've had both good and bad experiences. I've had some really great ones. And I've also had some not so great ones. For a long time, I didn't think people really cared. They knew I was involved with this, but no one really said anything to me. The first thing I got was a phone call from a leader just asking that, you know, Relief Society is fine, it's all women, but like in classes with like Sunday school and sacrament, maybe I should kind of think about covering up or going to the mother's lounge. And I kind of felt like that leader had been confronted by someone else in the ward. I didn't know who. I just figured someone had gone to them and said, hey, can you talk to Heather about this, instead of confronting me. So I told that leader, both my husband and I feel that I am being modest enough. And because I'm not standing up and being like, hey, everybody, I'm going to take off my shirt now and do a little striptease. You know, it's none of that. It's just, you know, pulling my shirt down. And at that point in time, I was still doing layers. So I'd pull up my shirt, have a layer of fabric there. And I didn't think anyone could even see. You'd have to be looking hard to see nipple. And so I told that leader, I was like, you know, thanks for your concern. We feel like we're handling it appropriately. And I was like, I'm guessing that someone came to you about this, and just tell them in the future, if someone comes up to you, that we feel like we are handling this well. If you have other concerns, just please talk to us personally. And the leader at that time said that they would do that. A few months later, another leader higher up in the ranking asked us to go to the temple and pray about it. And so I was like, well, okay. And we went to the temple, and in the celestial room, I remember turning to McKay. I was like, so McKay, well, how are you feeling? He's like, I'm not really feeling like it's a big deal. And I was like, yeah, me neither. So we went to the temple and we prayed about it, and we felt that our answer was keep on going. So we just kept going with what we were doing. A few months later, we were walking home from church, and another member of the ward was also walking home from church, and he turned around and really got on me about breastfeeding and how I was encouraging pornography use, causing people to turn to pornography, you know, and stuff like that. All these terrible things. And it was really like both of us, McKay and I, we did not know what to do. We just turned off to where we were heading home, and I went home and we were really shaken up about this. I went home and I just cried. It was really stressful. And we had recently had a lesson in church about being Zion, and I felt really gung-ho about loving my ward and how we're going to be so great. And then I just, the most devastating feeling I had was, they don't want me in their Zion. They would rather I not be there. And I felt really rejected by my ward. And it's just one person, but that was the feeling I had that day. And I asked McKay for a blessing. And in that blessing, I was told to not give up and that I was doing what I should be doing. And so I said, okay, I won't give up. And I actually had intended to talk to that ward member. I'd written out what I was going to say politely and everything, and I'd memorized it. And they just didn't show up. I didn't show up to church for like 3 more weeks. And a month later, it was kind of, I'm not going to bring it up again. So did not confront him. But in that time, that month or so that happened, I had another member of the ward come to me. I talk about breastfeeding a lot because I do it a lot. And there had been a discussion once about breastfeeding and whether or not it's appropriate in public. And he had said that he felt, in that conversation, he felt that it actually might help people with pornography use because they would actually see what breasts are for. They wouldn't be sexualizing them so much. And he actually came up to me at that point and said, you know, Heather, the reason I said that was because it helped me. And he said that he was once looking at something online and he remembered me breastfeeding and said that he closed the browser. When he told me that story, I was so, well, grateful that he shared that story with me. And also, it was assuring that the accusations of me causing pornography problems were unfounded. And actually, it was the reverse, that I was actually helping people inadvertently. I've also other positive breastfeeding stories in church. There was a woman who was like once just kind of watching me in church nursing my daughter in Relief Society. And a week later, she came to me. She's like, Heather, I hope you don't mind that I was like peeking over at you. I hope you didn't feel uncomfortable. But I was having a hard time breastfeeding my daughter, and I just wanted to watch someone do it. And I was getting to the point where we were going to switch to formula, but seeing you breastfeed in church made me rededicate myself. And she said that she called a lactation consultant that night and was able to breastfeed her daughter for actually over a year. So I've had some really good experiences with breastfeeding in church as well.
Has it been easier now that you're in California?
Oh, yes. I have not had anyone say anything to me in California. So I just breastfeed in my pew, and I've never had anyone say anything. They all know, well, the first week we were there, or the first month, they had like an intro on the fifth Sunday. They have the new families introduce themselves during Sunday school, or no, they combined the Relief Society priesthood. And in our introduction, I was up there and I said, well, I'm a lactivist, and I explained what that was. And so I think the board kind of understands that I'm not going to be swayed by their... And our board is so wonderful that I don't think anyone has a problem with it at all.
So was it before or after you moved to California that you started up your Green Garment campaign?
It was after I moved to California. I've always been really in love with the earth. In second grade, we watched a video about how many, like, they had pictures of landfills just filled with trash. And I came home that day and I was like, Mom, we have to recycle. And we were living in rural Indiana at this point. And she was like, Heather, we have a compost pile. We have a farm, or not a farm, but a huge garden. And I think we're okay with living here. And I thought that was the most terrible thing, that she would just not want to recycle. I thought she was a terrible, earth-hating person. And I was like part of the recycling club in elementary school. And I've always just, I love the earth. I don't even know where it came from. And I'm always up for like new ways to like try to reduce the waste and stuff. And a friend of mine, she is a doula, and she went out to Utah, and she was discussing garments and stuff and how, you know, it's not like there's an easy way to dispose of them, and they're all made of synthetic fabrics and stuff. And between the two of them came up with this, like, well, what if they made, you know, greener garments that like were made of more natural fibers, and there are ways to reuse them better or recycle them. And she mentioned that on the forum, and I was like, that we should do that. That sounds like a great idea. And what we need to do is ask for it, because, you know, the church has on their website a link for suggestions. And I know they take suggestions, because every few years or so, somewhere on the blog or NACL, someone will say, hey, I got this, you know, survey, and they want to know what we can change. And I think through those surveys, that's why they have the Karenessa fabrics and stuff, because people said, I want a more form-fitting fabric that looks better under my clothes. And so they came up with that. And so they're looking for suggestions always. And so I figured, you know, well, why don't we ask for more natural fibers? Why don't we ask for, if we have polyester, why don't we ask for recycled polyester? And so for Earth Day this year, I made up a little Facebook event, so it would be easy for people to share it and get people to email. Just email into the email address that the church provides saying, hey, you know, I really like my garments, and I would really like my garments to be made out of natural fibers. And it was just a small, like, just send them a couple, you know, only a couple sentences, you know. And
have you had any response at all?
The people who have emailed the letter have received a response that says, you know, we'll send these on to Beehive Clothing. But that's as far as we have heard. A lot of the kickback that we got on, like, the Facebook page was, you know, this is going to make it too expensive for members to buy garments. But at the moment, I would just love the option. And just like the Karenessa tops and bottoms are slightly more expensive than the rest, and the rest stayed at their current, you know, prices. If we just had the option, and those of us who can afford it and want it could have that option. And then maybe as the church and as the whole country is going towards more organic and sustainable fabrics. As that switches over and more farmers go that route, they'll become cheaper, I feel, because they'll be more available.
It's fascinating to hear about all of your different interests. It sounds like you have many ideas and projects that come in and out of what you're working on at the moment, which makes you a very interesting type of person to be in the middle of a fairly conservative church. What is your current relationship with the church? Where does it feel like a good fit, and where does it feel maybe more uneasy?
Like I said at the beginning, I consider myself an active member of the church. I have a temple recommend, if that means anything to anyone. I haven't been to the temple in a while, though, because, oh, I have children and they are nurses. Well, Isaac has a lot of separation issues. The last time I went to the temple was when I was pregnant with him, and I went to do initiatories because I was having some struggles with the endowment session, the wording and some of it, so I thought I'd just go to initiatories. The endowment session and the existing relationship, and this sort of ties in with the unassisted childbirth stuff. I remember being young women's, I was probably 16 or something. They, you know, they have lessons about the temple. And like I said, you know, I felt when I was finding unassisted childbirth, oh my goodness, there's peaceful birth. I didn't think you could do that. I thought that would be totally turning to God and being like, your rules don't apply to me. because I thought that the rule was you're a woman, so childbirth has to be painful and dreadful and terrible. And I remember being told in young women's, well, it doesn't mean that childbirth is painful. It means that being a mother is very taxing and times do get hard. It's hard to have kids and those tears and stuff are related to that. But to my 16-year-old self, that just sounded like apologetics. I was like, no, really, we still think that women are going to be punished for use transgression. But I had been promised by a young woman leader, when you go to the temple, it'll be easier. It'll explain it better, and it won't seem so it's all Eve's fault. And I believed that that's what would happen, and it still felt like it was a lot of Eve's fault. And I was told it'll be more like a choice that she made and not something that she did wrong. And I remember going to the temple, and I listened, and I tried to figure out where they got this idea from. And I think it's a lovely idea to think that, oh, she made this choice and stuff, and it's not that she did something wrong, and that it was an empowered choice. But I still couldn't get that from the temple ceremony. I couldn't find that in the words or in the actions that you see. And I remember being really disappointed in that and thinking, okay, so where is this coming from? Where is this idea that this was an active choice? And I love that idea and I want to believe that idea. But I couldn't find it in the scriptures and I couldn't find it in the temple. And so when I was pregnant with Margaret and I was planning this unassisted birth, one of the biggest hurdles I had to overcome, besides the whole one I had ingrained with me that like doctors always know what's best, I had to overcome this view that childbirth has to be painful. And there was pain, but I didn't suffer. And I remember going to the temple and that didn't help. And it wasn't until I was probably around 32 weeks along and stuff, I was reading my scriptures and really boring scriptures. I was reading the articles of faith. Who sits around and reads those? You all haven't memorized from like primary. But I remember reading, we're not punished for Adam's transgression. And the idea came to me, we're not punished for Eve's either. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to ignore any of the implications in the scriptures and the temple that this was something that, like, because of her choosing to eat the fruit, that means that we all have to have terrible childbirth. I'm going to ignore all that because I'm not punished for her transgression. And I'm not going to believe that anymore. And that was one of my first temple-going confrontations that I just had. And that at that time, I didn't really consider myself like a Mormon feminist. I was very, very holding to the God at that point in my life. I still feel like I'm doing that, but I don't think the people around me consider me holding to the rod anymore so much. I have some struggles with like some of the wording in the temple endowment and some of the ideas. I still consider myself an active going member. I teach Sunbeams, go to church every Sunday. I love going to church. I love my ward, and it's really exciting for me to go to church. I feel bad if I miss church. I've actually gone to church more often than my husband has in the past year, and he's totally, totally for it, but he'll be the one that stays home with the kids. I'm like, I'm going to church. You're going to stay home with the kids if they're sick. You know, I want to go to church. And I will force myself to go to church sometimes if I'm not feeling 100% because I love it so much. But I know that there are people around me that don't consider me as iron rod holding as I used to be because of my mutual approbation blog and my desire to include Heavenly Mother. And that's kind of a fringe thought for some people. My testimony this past year, since moving to the Bay Area, I've been picking it apart a lot. Last summer, I went to Carolyn Pearson's house. She's actually in my stake. And so I went to her house for a blogger snacker for Feminist Mormon Housewives, and I met her, and they talked about Feminist Mormon stuff there, and I was already at that point reading Feminist Mormon Housewives regularly and stuff, and that's when I picked up my copy of Mother Will of the Morning, and I read that a few months later. I actually put off reading that because I knew that reading it would change my entire life, and I didn't want to change my life quite yet. And so I put it off for a few months. But yeah, since then, I have been re-evaluating what I really believe in. Last December, I told my husband that I was basically uprooting my garden. I see testimonies as a garden. And when you're a kid, your parents help you plant your garden, and they help you where to plant things. And like Alma considers, you know, things that you believe in faith to be a seed, and it grows into a tree or a beautiful plant. And I see that in my life, that we planted these trees. And I remember sitting and looking at this over the past year, and I look at my garden, and it's not how I want it to be at all. It's how, you know, the people around me, like the people who are teaching me, My parents were showing me where to plant the carrots and the peppers, and my church leaders were showing me where to plant these things. And I was looking at it, and they did a good job. It was a very good-looking garden of a testimony, but it wasn't what I wanted for my garden. And so I told my husband, I was like, you know, I'm uprooting this, and it's going to look like I don't care about these small things, these little plants that I'm uprooting. And I consider, like, say, a testimony of fasting to be one of the plants, and a testimony of prayer to be another, and of the scriptures, and of the prophet, and all of the things that you can have a testimony of to be all these little plants. And I said, and it's going to look like I'm totally uprooting them, but I'm going to replant them, and I'm going to plant them how I want them to be and how it reflects me as a person. And you just got to be patient. It's going to look like a total mess for a while, but it'll get better. And I believe that. So right now, I don't have a lot of little plants in my garden, and the ones that are there are kind of small. But I'm hoping that changing things around a little bit in my garden of a testimony will be a good thing in the end. And I do love the church, and I love going to church, and I don't want to abandon it at all. I think sometimes I've run into on the internet this idea of, well, if you don't like things, then just leave. And I don't think that's what Christ is about, and I don't think that's what the church should be about. I mentioned I love our ward at our stake conference this past winter. Our stake president talked a lot about the big tent of Mormonism and reaching out this tent. The area we live in is so wonderful for this. And I love that. And I use the story sometimes in talks and stuff. When the rich young man came to Christ and asked Christ, you know, how do I get to heaven? And Christ said, you know, you've got to sell everything you have. He walked away sadly, the young man. And Christ had said, just follow me. Christ didn't chase down that young man and say, hey, I told you the answer. You have to listen to me. This is what you have to do. If you don't, you're going to hell. He just let the young man walk away. And maybe that young man, 20 years from that point, would get to that point. And maybe that young man needed to go and ponder about it and find for himself that that was what he really needed to do. We don't know. And Christ didn't pressure him. He just said, follow me and come. I think sometimes we are ready to show other people the door when Christ is letting people in the door. And so I'm a believer in big tent Mormonism, and that everyone has a place in Mormonism if they want it. And if they don't want it, that's fine. I used to not feel that way. I felt like everyone had to believe a certain way. And I don't anymore. That's part of my replanting my garden. But I believe that if you want a place in Mormonism, you should have a place in Mormonism. And I feel like I deserve a place.
I really love your analogy of the testimony garden. That's such a great way to visualize it. What are some of the key plants that you've put into your replanted garden lately?
I'm working on planting prayer better. For a while, I was having issues with how do I want to pray, especially since I want to incorporate Heavenly Mother in my life better. And part of that is my mutual approbation blog, which is one way that I can do that. So I'm working on the prayer thing. What I love about my garden analogy is that I think everyone has a little garden, and I think everyone's going to have plants that aren't doing as well. And you can look over at someone's garden and be like, oh my goodness, your fasting plant is so low. It is a tiny little thing. You have no testimony of fasting. But your own garden has things that aren't watered well. And we all spend sometimes more on parts of our garden than other parts. I know that when I was going through various cycles of trying to figure out what faith was, I would talk about faith a lot, like in comments in Sunday school, and because that was something I was really, really hooked on. And so at that point in my life, my faith plant of faith of faith, I guess, was getting a lot of attention, and other plants I wasn't really focusing on so much. And I think everyone does that. Everyone will focus on some plants more than others at times of their life. I'm trying to get back into reading scriptures more often. That's kind of something that my mutual approbation blog has really done for me.
You mentioned that your mutual approbation blog has brought you a little bit of scrutiny from some of the people in your life, that they feel like maybe you're not as faithful as you used to be. What kind of responses have they given you?
I've had just, and some of it's random comments. I used to accept anonymous comments on the blog. Some of the criticism that I got was, oh, we can't talk about Heavenly Mother because she's not supposed to be talked about, and you doing it is just blasphemous. Rewriting scriptures is blasphemous. I'm not trying to rewrite scripture. I'm just trying to include her just as a way to think about her more often. And I specifically say that in the About page. And I told that person who had suggested that, I was like, I specifically say I'm not trying to do that. And they were like, well, but people aren't going to read your About page. And I'm like, well, then that's their issue, you know? Because I really do love the church, and I'm not trying to, I don't think I'm trying to be fringe or anything, but I guess I am. Other things that have been criticisms. Oh, just that, you know, you don't talk about these things. That's pretty much the biggest criticism, is things we don't talk about the temple outside the temple. This is one of those things. But, you know, in the temple, you covenant not to say things. I've never covenanted not to mention Heavenly Mother.
Does it seem that maybe your mutual approbation blog in some ways kind of reflects what you're planting in your garden right now?
It does. I'm definitely paying more attention to my Heavenly Mother plant in my garden right now, because that one's been neglected for so long in my life. There is a post on there about like my relationship with Heavenly Mother throughout my life, and she got neglected for my teen and college years, and I want to put some more water on that one right now.
One of the things I love about your garden analogy is that, like, if I just walk around my neighborhood here, I get to see lots of different kinds of gardens, and they reflect the personalities of the people who plant them and tend them and care for them, and they all have different plants, and they're set up differently, and some of them are very wild and free, and some of them are, they're so manicured. And then there are very minimalist gardens where they've got four things, and then there's gardens where there's tons of things. And so I like this idea of everyone having their own garden and it being okay that the gardens are all different.
And sometimes someone might be thinking, oh my goodness, we live in X state and only such and such plants grow here, and everyone should only have these plants, or these plants are native here, or these plants grow best during this time of year. And you think everyone should have those exact plants that you might be having. But, you know, some people might be trying to grow okra in Utah, and that's okay. They're learning, and they might find out that okra grows really well with however they're doing it, or they might find out it doesn't work well. I choose okra in Utah because I tried to grow okra in Utah when we were in Provo in a pot that didn't work well at all. And just because someone's trying a plant that you're not familiar with or you don't think will grow well where they are, doesn't mean that it will, that it's a wrong choice. And they might find that they need to alter maybe their gardening strategy or try a different plant. I don't know. I love that analogy. That's how I see a lot of things.
So as you have uprooted a bunch of your garden and are replanting other pieces, what are some of the resources that have helped you on this journey that you've been on?
As far as internet ones, I like the Mormon Stories podcast because it gives you a lot of good information with church history. I love hearing people's testimonies. I think that when John Dillon asks people to share their testimonies, that I think is so valuable and has strengthened my testimony a lot. I love the way different people look at the gospel. And I love learning more information about, say, how the Masonic Mormon connection is and stuff like that. That's interesting too. I also love various Facebook groups I'm in. People talk about different things, and I love reading the Blog Vernacle. I read Feminist Mormon Housewives and The Exponent. Oh, I love Zelepha Head's Daughters. Oh, that's such a good one. I think they are zingy. I think Feminist Mormon Housewives does a good job of being a little bit more moderate than people realize. And Zelepha Head's Daughters, they really put in the punch. They are witty. They are satirical. They're good. I love it. I don't think they're necessarily more feminist than Feminist Mormon Housewives, but they don't hold any punches. And I think the satire is brilliant there. I love The Exponent. And I, as far as books and stuff, I loved The Dance of the Descendant Daughter and Mother Wove the Morning. I think everyone should read Mother Wove the Morning. Other resources, I love my ward. Like, I know people have, like, the church's true testimonies. My ward is true. They are true people. They are very real people. I feel like I can, they're a safe place. Like, I could say things like, you know, I'm not really sure about this. And they would be like, okay, that's cool. They won't show me the door. That's what I love about my ward.
What are your hopes for being part of this podcast?
I hope that I have some interesting stories. I feel like I just shared all my interesting stories, and now I've got nothing interesting to say anymore. I hope I have a good perspective, an interesting perspective to add to some of the topics. I do come from a very privileged, well, as privileged as a woman can be in the church. I have a family. I'm married, and I've got two kids, and I'm exactly what people like to smile upon, you know, and give flowers to at Mother's Day. I'm the intended recipient for all of that sort of talk. And so I feel like I can't really say too much because I got some white privilege. What do they call it when, yeah, white guilt? Well, I feel like I've got young mother guilt. Like, I can't really add things because everything is basically designed for me. But I think I do have an interesting twist on the young mother thing in my activism and other activist ways.
So I have one last question, and it's a little bit random. I should have asked it earlier, but I was too caught up in what you were saying. With your history of being a lactivist and so forth, is there a difference for you between the words nursing and breastfeeding?
Okay. Yes and no. I've had an interesting relationship with those words. For a long time, I insisted on calling it breastfeeding. And I know that's very contrary to a lot of people's, what they would guess. Because a lot of people say, oh, breastfeeding makes it turn out to be just feeding and not the mother-child relationship, which breastfeeding is very wonderful. Like, it is a relationship, and you shouldn't downplay that relationship. And a lot of people feel that saying breastfeeding downplays that relationship, and it turns it into just feeding a child. But I insisted on calling it breastfeeding, and only breastfeeding, for a long time on my blog, because I wanted people to get over the word breast. I wanted them to be able to hear the word breast more often and get over the issues and the sexual connotations of the word. And so for a long time, I only called it breastfeeding. Now, depending on where I am on the internet, I will call it nursing or breastfeeding. And by that, I mean, like on Twitter, I call it breastfeeding, or BFing is the Twitter hashtag. Because if you mention nursing, people are searching nursing for like nursing student stuff, you know. I do designate that breastfeeding on Twitter and things like that. But I will say nursing if I now use them interchangeably. I do think that the relationship is important, and that turning into just feeding is a problem. But for me, it was more important to emphasize that breasts do this, and breasts are okay, and they're not something that's dirty. And so I, for a long time, for a couple years, only used the word breastfeeding for my blog.
Well, this has just been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for telling us about all of your interesting projects and ideas and about your garden.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for listening to Daughters of Mormonism. I invite you to respond at daughtersofmormonism.blogspot.com. If you have ideas for future episodes or would like to be interviewed on the podcast, I'd love to hear from you. Thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the music.